This BBC podcast is supported by ads outside the UK.
An Bord erwarten Sie Bars, Spa-Duschen sowie preisgekrönte Bordunterhaltung. Es ist also kein Wunder, dass Emirates als beste Fluggesellschaft der Welt ausgezeichnet wurde. Wir fliegen Sie zu über 140 Reisezielen. Und mit unseren Interline-Partnern weltweit bieten wir Ihnen Anschlussflüge zu weiteren 1700 Städten auf 6 Kontinenten. Wenn wir behaupten, dass wir eine der größten internationalen Fluggesellschaften sind, meinen wir, wir bringen Sie an Ihr Wunschziel. Jetzt buchen auf emirates.de. Fly Emirates, fly better.
This week on Witness History, it's France's rockstar philosopher Jacques Derrida, who's famous for his theory of deconstruction that shook the foundations of Western thought and popular culture. He inspired everyone from anti-colonial activists to feminists to architects to fashionistas. Derrida is everywhere. Listen on Witness History, the podcast that takes you to the biggest moments in history, told by the people who were there. Search and subscribe to Witness History wherever you get your BBC podcasts.
Cuernavaca, Mexico, in the year 2000. This is a meeting of earth scientists, and Paul Crutzen is getting cross. He's already a Nobel Prize winner, known for his breakthrough work on the ozone layer. He's doing his best to listen, but the speakers are referring over and over again to something called the Holocene, the geological time period stretching back about 12,000 years. But Paul believes that the world is now radically different. Talking as if it isn't is missing something fundamental, something really urgent. He shoots up. Stop saying the Holocene, he barks. We're not in the Holocene anymore. But, one attendee ventures cautiously, if we're no longer in the Holocene, what period are we in? What the people in this room could not have known then was that this brief exchange would launch a global quest, a quest which would reveal striking insights into our changing Earth, a quest that would end in maddening failure. I'm Hannah Fry, a mathematician who studies patterns in human behaviour. This is Uncharted, Tales of Data and Discovery.
I first visited Crawford Lake in either 1984 or 85.
This is Francine McCarthy, a professor at Brock University in Canada.
My master's supervisor, Jock McAndrews, is the guy credited with having discovered the almost magical properties of Crawford Lake.
But it's what lies deep down inside the lake that makes it magical.
You can clearly see that it is limestone bedrock. You can see the walls of the sinkhole, and it is exceptionally deep for its size.
It turns out that 24 metres down, the lake holds an incredibly rich and detailed memory, because down in the deepest depths at the bottom of Crawford Lake, the water sits perfectly calm and still. And so bits of dust and debris, seeds, pollen and pollutants that float down from the world above are not jumbled in together. They gently arrive, preserved in extraordinarily neat layers.
We have every year crisp, clear, unequivocal, that is almost never found in the geologic record. It's like a barcode in that there's a really distinct pattern.
Francine and her colleagues know exactly how to read this barcode. They can see when maize was first grown in the 13th century, cultivated by the locally indigenous Wendat people. And then in 1883, a sudden colour change as sawdust from a newly established sawmill enters the sediment. And then into the middle of the 20th century, a sharp increase in tiny spherical particles called fly ash, belched out by coal-powered furnaces used for making steel. You'll find these barcodes in rock formations too. But rocks have even longer memories, and every now and then their layers will contain something known as a golden spike. Not really golden, it's not really a spike, but it is the term that geologists use for a signature in the rock that marks a profound change in the life of the planet. Like, for example, a catastrophic impact. 66 million years ago, an asteroid the size of Mount Everest smashed into Earth. After the tsunamis and earthquakes had faded, a dust cloud dimmed sunlight for years. A mass extinction followed, wiping out almost all of the dinosaurs. And its impact can be seen today, because this asteroid, pulverized into fine particles, was spread as a thin layer around the globe. A layer full of a rare metal called iridium. This is the golden spike that marks the beginning of the Paleocene, a dramatic new phase of life on Earth. Back at the conference, the weight of Paul Crutzen's words was sinking into the room. If we had entered another epoch, another phase of life on Earth, then something had changed that was as seismic as the impact of an asteroid hitting the planet. We're in the Anthropocene, he says. The human age.
Paul Crutzen suggested the invention of James Watt's steam engine in the late 18th century, that might be a good place to think about looking for the boundary.
This is Professor Mark Williams, a paleobiologist who formed part of a group trying to figure out when this uncertain period had begun. When had humans become not just inhabitants, but a geological force? How far back should you go? The group considered scores of different possible starting points, but eventually consensus settled somewhere surprising.
As we developed these ideas, we arrived very much at the conclusion that the most significant change during the time that humans as a group of species have been on this planet is really the post-World War II period.
Now, that might come as a bit of a shock. That is within the lifetime of many people around now, maybe some of you listening to this. But what about the millennia of human impact before then? Well, here is environmental historian John McNeill.
In the 20th century, the scale, scope and pace of global environmental change outstripped that of any point in the last 10,000 years or so, especially since 1950. Since 1950, various indicators of global environmental change and the driving forces behind it had accelerated sharply.
It's called the Great Acceleration, a process best revealed in a whole bevy of eye-popping graphs.
The Anthropocene is built on graphs. It's built on graphs which go from more or less horizontal for thousands of years and then climb up to be almost a vertical wall in the last century or so, with the steepest climb being in the last 70 years. It's quite a remarkable coincidence of different trends, you know, all going in the same direction.
That's Jan Zalasiewicz, who led the group of researchers. Studying the Anthropocene has taken up decades of his life's work. The Great Acceleration was dramatic. Take, for instance, the global population. In 1900, there were around 1.6 billion people on Earth. By 1950, that had grown steadily to 2.5 billion. But after that, it shoots up. By the year 2000, we had passed 6 billion people. And now, we are at over 8 billion. And this pattern is repeated again and again. Carbon dioxide emissions, they start to creep up from the Industrial Revolution. But it's only after 1950 that the gradient curves steeply upward, the large majority of all historical emissions occurring after that point. And it's also true of human-made materials, which will become the rock layers and fossils of the future.
Plastics is one, because plastics have now become part of geology. They've gone everywhere, none indeed, for thousands of years, creeping in the early 20th century, and then zooming up from about a million tonnes a year in 1950 to now something like 400 million tonnes a year. The graph of concrete, very similar, been used for thousands of years, but then the climb since the mid-20th century is astronomical. You know, enough to have a kilo of concrete on every square metre of the Earth's surface, land and sea, with almost all of that since 1950 or so.
So the group were closing in on a moment in time, but they would need to persuade a consortium of hard-nosed and argumentative geologists from around the world. They still needed that golden spike, their equivalent layer of iridium, a line in the rock where the future had begun. And that is when one researcher remembered the magical properties of Crawford Lake and dropped in on Francine.
So he stopped by my office to ask if Crawford Lake might be an excellent possible candidate for this golden spike. And I said, absolutely. So he then said, well, are you willing to do the hard work to convince the world of that? And I said, sure.
There was one measure that they were especially interested in: the debris from a series of massive explosions, the fallout from nuclear bombs. In 1945, the US became the world's first nuclear power. In 1949, the Soviet Union joined them in hot pursuit. And throughout the 1950s, this frightening new technology was continuously developed in scores of test detonations around the globe, expelling huge quantities of distinctive radioactive dust into the atmosphere. Could that provide the marker, the golden spike that they needed?
It didn't seem likely to me that Crawford Lake, a little tiny lake in Canada, would have a very strong nuclear weapons testing signature.
Canada never had its own nuclear weapons program. It seemed unlikely. But Francine was committed, and so precious samples of sediment from deep under the lake, each layer marking 1 year, were carefully collected and sent for analysis.
The plutonium analysts in Southampton and Vienna could not believe the data. I mean, they were astounded themselves, and they look at these data as part of their everyday lives.
The timing of early nuclear tests correlates precisely with the quantity of radioactive dust concentrated in each layer. But how? Well, it was while watching the movie Oppenheimer that it clicked.
Most of the early testing was in the southwestern United States desert. The prevailing winds from the southwestern United States come right over the Great Lakes. So that's how we in Crawford Lake have a stronger record than any of the other sites.
This had to be it, the Anthropocene's golden spike. The researchers even agreed on an exact date, the 1st of November 1952, the day the first ever hydrogen bomb was tested on the Marshall Islands, a moment marked in rock. It had taken the researchers 15 years, but amid hundreds of pages of formal evidence, they had pinpointed the exact moment that the world had irrevocably shifted from one epoch to another. And now, all they needed to do was persuade their colleagues, and the date would then be set in stone too. Except, things didn't exactly go as planned.
Geologists reject the Anthropocene
Geologists
as Earth's
Geologists make it
epoch.
Official. We're not in an Anthropocene
Quest
epoch.
Quest to declare Anthropocene an epoch descends into epic
Surprise
now.
Decision not to define the Anthropocene shocks scientists.
Proposal to mark a new chapter in Earth history rejected.
The researchers were utterly dismayed.
It feels very empty and it feels very confusing.
It does seem totally crazy to me.
To my mind, the vote was absurdly premature.
We've heard everything through the media.
More geologists are being interviewed by the press this week than in the entire history of the world.
We don't know where anything stands. We don't know what to do next. This is uncharted territory.
Fixing one moment in time where human influence crosses some threshold was seen by their colleagues as unnecessary. But here is the ridiculous thing. Even the critics agree that, however you define the Anthropocene, we are definitely in it. Paul Crutzen was right. But those years of work, the layers of rock and dust and sediment, still tell an undeniable story. Something profound has shifted in the dynamics of the planet.
The line on the timescale is not my goal. The overarching goal was to have people recognize the immensity of that change and that it's not going away.
Next on Uncharted, a quiet Italian town experiences small tremors. Are they just passing phase or a warning of something bigger?
Deep under the Abruzzo region of Italy, two tectonic plates meet. These thick slabs of hardened earth crust have buckled into a giant ridge running down the centre of the country. The Apennine mountain range, in one of its valleys, is the city of L'Aquila. It was here on the afternoon of March 30th, 2009, that the ground suddenly moved. There have already been months of frequent small tremors, but this is more powerful. And so the next day, a group of earthquake scientists are on their way, summoned in response to the growing disquiet. They know the long history of earthquakes in the region. Can they provide the security the people of L'Aquila need? I'm Hannah Fry, a mathematician who studies patterns in human behaviour. This is Uncharted, Tales of Data and Discovery. Just the year before, Giulio Rosati had started at the university, drawn to L'Aquila's small-town charm.
Io stavo bene, il mio percorso di studi proseguiva bene.
My studies were progressing well, and I'd settled in quite a bit. Basically, L'Aquila had become my second home. The real social life in L'Aquila took place in the city centre, around the Piazza Duomo, the Fontana Luminosa, and in the spring, the park in front of the Basilica of Colomaggio. I knew that L'Aquila, like many other cities and areas of central Italy, was at high seismic risk, but it wasn't something people talked about before 2009.
Liliana Centofanti also knows the area well. She was studying nearby while her brother, Davide, was at L'Aquila University.
He was happy to be there. He was in his first year of management engineering, and he was really happy to have found almost a second family.
Davide and his friends, they noticed the tremors, but like Giulia, they didn't feel especially worried. They loved it here. And besides, the authorities were making a concerted effort to keep people calm.
The message that constantly reached those who lived in L'Aquila was a message of reassurance. They even drove by with vans, loudspeakers, precisely to reassure the population.
Inevitably, however, some were starting to feel anxious. Aquilani families have long memories, like in 1703, where the ground shook so violently that the soil turned to liquid and the city was almost entirely destroyed in a matter of moments. These families have a tradition. When serious tremors start, they go outside. Some would gather in the piazza and sleep in their cars, just in case. And with this latest tremor, on the 30th of March, people are deciding what to do. L'Aquila had been experiencing regular little tremors, tens of them every month. Most of them were small, officially microquakes. I want you to imagine those tremors on a graph, a dot for each quake, their magnitude on one side, the date along the bottom. L'Aquila's graph ordinarily shows dots scattered along a horizontal band, none reaching particularly high. But then, in late January 2009, the tremors start to happen more often. A dense cluster of dots appears on the page. They're all still fairly weak, topping out at around 2.5 in magnitude, but much more frequent. In March 2009, a slowdown. White space shows through on the graph. And then, at 3:38 p.m. on March 30th, a sudden shift. The biggest tremor the residents of L'Aquila had felt in a long time. Buildings shake, glasses wobble on the shelves, some antique bits of plaster crack. It's a magnitude of 4.1, officially a light earthquake. But it's enough to stoke tensions.
The great scare yesterday afternoon showed the population's unpreparedness for such a calamity. Hundreds poured into the streets and squares of the historic centre.
But what comes next on the graph? Stretching out to the right is the blank unknown of days in the future. Will the dots return now to their usual height? Or is this rumble a sign of something bigger to come? This is Vanna Mazzocchi, a professor of geophysics and natural hazard forecasting at the University of Naples.
During a seismic sequence, the probability of large earthquake is increased. For instance, the probability to have a big earthquake in one specific region usually can be 1 per 100,000 per week, then during a seismic sequence, this can increase and becomes 1 over 100.
That is a huge increase, and yet 1%. But it was enough to demand a meeting of the Major Risks Commission the following day. Three seismologists, two seismic engineers and a volcanologist, along with the Deputy Head of Civil Protection, Bernardo Bernardines, assembled on the evening of March 31st. What exactly was said at this meeting is still a matter of fierce controversy. But the minutes, which were only released later, include statements like the following, read here in translation.
It is unlikely that there will be a shock like the one in 1703 soon, although it cannot be absolutely
Professor
ruled
Barberi
out.
Professor Barberi highlights how it is extremely difficult to make predictions on how seismic phenomena will develop over
Obviously,
time.
Since the area of L'Aquila is seismic, it's not possible to say that there will be no earthquakes.
The tone of these clips is not exactly conclusive. They show a group of scientists conscious of the uncertainty of the moment. After the meeting, media outlets shared interview clips of Bernardo Bernardines, the man who had chaired the group but wasn't himself an expert. It's there that he made a comment that the people of L'Aquila would come to bitterly regret.
The scientific community continues to confirm that it is actually a favourable situation because there is a continuous release of energy and therefore, essentially, if there are tremors, they're not super intense. So I think we'll cope.
Here was what seemed to be a statement of fact, that any bigger earthquakes could be ruled out. That wasn't true. Bernardines had actually made those comments before the meeting with the scientists, but it was reported as though he'd said it afterwards, almost as a summary. Just after 3 a.m. on the morning of April 6th, Julia was winding down from a night out, but she wasn't in L'Aquila. Julia was in her hometown over 100 kilometres away.
We had gone to a karaoke night and were on our way home. We stopped in a bar to have breakfast before going to sleep. And at a certain point, I recognised the sound of the earthquake. I call it the roar. It seemed like a split second to me, but suddenly there was this very strong shock. And we ran out, and then from the television, from the bar, news started arriving.
For Liliana, the night is as vivid as when it happened.
I was in Pescara, and even before the house started shaking, I actually felt the tremor. I started to get out of bed, but I couldn't, because it arrived, a powerful shockwave. Immediately after the shock, I turned on the TV. When the images of what had happened started coming in, I heard my mother. Well, she tried to call Davide, but he wasn't answering.
When the images started being shared on the news, Liliana recognised the student house with a sense of dread. The block where her brother Davide was living had collapsed. 309 people died that night, and Davide was among them.
Within the last hour and a half or so, a massive earthquake has struck central Italy with its epicenter.
The major tremor shook the area in the early hours of the morning. This man pulled free from the rubble that was once his home.
A major earthquake, 5.9 on the Richter scale, had hit the town at 3:32 a.m. on April 6th, followed by a rapid series of aftershocks. It was just 6 days after the Major Risks Commission.
The first time I returned to L'Aquila, L'Aquila was a destroyed and silent city. It was a ghost town.
More than 1,600 were injured, and in the immediate aftermath, around 67,000 people were now homeless. As the dust settled, resentment and anger grew. Some people had taken the decision not to leave, not to sleep in their cars, because of the idea that the tremors were releasing energy safely. In 2011, the scientists who had attended the Major Risks Commission were to be prosecuted in court. The prosecutor alleged that their risk assessment had been inadequate and led to misleading messages being given to the public. He claimed there was blood on their hands. Professor Varna Mazzocchi was not part of the Major Risks Commission that night.
When you say the probability of large earthquake is 1%, people say, oh, it's small. Actually, there are no small or high probability. This strongly depends on the consequences. But if I say you have 1% probability to have a flight accident, I think then nobody is going to catch a flight.
In this series, we've focused on stories where data saves the day. The L'Aquila earthquake is not one of those tales. And how we feel about a risk, how much we ought to fear the consequences of what it represents, must factor in how we interpret it. And it's that last step, including our own personal feelings and fears and interpretations of risk, that I think can't be done for us. It can't be done and shouldn't be done in an offhand comment that shields us from seeing the underlying uncertainty. What happened in those weeks, who was responsible and what lives could have been saved, is fiercely contested. In 2012, the scientists were sentenced to 6 years in prison for manslaughter. But their conviction was overturned by the Supreme Court in 2015, before they had served any time. Only Bernardo Bernardines' conviction was upheld. Relatives of those who died blame irresponsible analysis and messaging, while the seismologists feel that their views were unfairly distorted. Werner, meanwhile, has tried to learn what he can from this painful experience, about how important it is to emphasise the uncertainty of what is known, not just trying to control or reassure when the data does not allow it. Slowly and painfully, L'Aquila is rebuilding. It has been crowned Italy's Capital of Culture of 2026, which will help bring new investment and new visitors to this historic town. But the residents won't forget those that they lost. On April 6th, 2024, starting at 3:32 in the morning, the bells of Santa Maria del Suffragio began to chime. 309 times they rang out, one for each victim.
An Bord erwarten Sie Bars, Spa-Duschen sowie preisgekrönte Bordunterhaltung. Es ist also kein Wunder, dass Emirates als beste Fluggesellschaft der Welt ausgezeichnet wurde. Wir fliegen Sie zu über 140 Reisezielen. Und mit unseren Interline-Partnern weltweit bieten wir Ihnen Anschlussflüge zu weiteren 1700 Städten auf 6 Kontinenten. Wenn wir behaupten, dass wir eine der größten internationalen Fluggesellschaften sind, meinen wir, wir bringen Sie an Ihr Wunschziel. Jetzt buchen auf emirates.de. Fly Emirates, fly better.
Yoga is more than just exercise. It's the spiritual practice that millions swear by. And in 2017, Miranda, a university tutor from London, joins a yoga school that promises profound transformation.
It felt a really safe and welcoming space. After the yoga classes, I felt amazing.
But soon, that calm, welcoming atmosphere leads to something far darker, a journey that leads to allegations of grooming, trafficking and exploitation across international borders.
I don't have my passport, I don't have my phone, I don't have my bank cards, I have nothing.
The passport being taken, the being in a house and not feeling like they can leave.
World of Secrets is where untold stories are unveiled and hidden realities are exposed. In this new series, we're confronting the dark side of the wellness industry, where the hope of a spiritual breakthrough gives way to disturbing accusations.
You just get sucked in so gradually, and it's done so skillfully that you don't realise.
And it's like this secret that's there. I wanted to believe that, you know, that whatever they were doing, even if it seemed gross to me, was for some spiritual reason that I couldn't yet understand.
Revealing the hidden secrets of a global yoga network.
I feel that I have no other choice. The only thing I can do is to
speak about this and to put my reputation and everything else on the line. I want truth and justice. And for other people to not be hurt, for things to be different in the future.
To bring it into the light and almost alchemize some of that evil stuff that went on and take back the power.
World of Secrets, Season 6, The Bad Guru. Listen wherever you get your podcasts.